Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Gabby Whithouse in this episode. Gabby began her online education work following her own online education experience, and her efforts to extend the reach of education to refugees and displaced persons continues alongside her roles with University College London and the University of Birmingham. This podcast is sponsored by the International Council for Open and Distance Education, ICDE, the leading global membership organization working towards bringing inclusive, quality education to all. By joining the ICDE global network of flexible and distance learning, you can help transform the world through inclusive education. Become a member or find out more by visiting www.icde.org. I'm talking with Dr. Gabby Whithouse, who works at University College London as a research fellow specialising in education in contexts of mass displacement. Gabby is also senior digital education developer with the University of Birmingham. She's a keen advocate of open education resources and widening participation to higher education. Hi there, Gabby. It's good to be talking with you.
Hi, Mark. Thank you very much for having me.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
All right. Well, I started my career in the mid-1980s, not in academia, but in South Africa in the NGO sector doing adult literacy work. This was very much in the heat of the apartheid years, and there were estimated to be about 16 million adults who had, by design of the apartheid government, either never been to school or only had very limited schooling. So it was a massive task.
Wow.
Yeah, and there was this fantastic network across the country of what we called night schools that was running informally, mainly staffed by volunteers in church halls, synagogues, and, you know, empty community halls and things. Mm. I was a student at the time. I was studying Zulu language, which helped a lot in that work, and social anthropology. Mm-hmm. And for me, this was my sort of practical contribution to social justice. So it was a very intense time. And it was my political awakening because apartheid had been so incredibly successful. Your listeners won't know that I'm putting inverted commas around that while I speak, in its own terms, in that we were so separated from one another that I had never previously been in the same room with people of other races as equals. Mm. And yet here we were as volunteers all coming together with the same goal and sharing knowledge and learning together and developing our skills together and so on. So that was absolutely formative for me. And during that time, I encountered Paulo Freire, well, not him, but his work, obviously. And that made a huge impression on me. I just consumed that, you know, with so much passion and excitement because it just spoke to me about what was happening, the inequalities were just so vividly clear to me in that context. Mm. And then I was in my early 20s and all of us in this community were trying out everything we learned. Mm. We were just implementing it immediately. And I'll just tell you this one story to kind of contextualize the whole thing.
Yeah.
So one of the other volunteer tutors had a group of students who were being terribly exploited at work. They all worked together as cleaners in a home for the elderly. Mm. And they were scrubbing the floors on their knees. They weren't given proper tools to work with. They were overworked. They worked every hour of the day and so on. And so through the literacy classes, their teacher got them doing role plays to try and improve their working circumstances.
Yeah.
And very quickly, they all got fired without any notice. There was no legal protection for them. And we got together in one of these workshops, you know, where the teacher came back and said, look, I did this, because we'd all helped her prepare the role play. And we're all very excited about, you know, conscientizing the people and, you know.
Yeah.
improving their access to justice and everything. And that happened. And it was such a wake-up call to me that, you know, we live in the real world and you have to always measure your actions against the reality of the power structures that exist.
Yeah.
And what happened subsequently was all of them but one negotiated through with the help of further role plays in the literacy class, negotiated to get their jobs back. And one didn't, and we never saw her again. Those things were just happening on a weekly basis there, and that was a real baptism by fire for me into, you know, increasing access to education in a very, very low-tech environment. So I worked in that environment until the late 90s, early 2000s. And during that time, South Africa had its transition to democracy and the scope of our work expanded. So instead of only working with the NGOs and the trade unions, I also worked with some big businesses and South African Airways and that kind of thing, because there was a huge need for training of the workforce. So there was a lot of sort of adult basic education for employment.
Yeah.
I expanded my experience a bit by working internationally for a few years in the early 2000s, doing curriculum development and English language teaching. And that was interesting for me, but it never had quite the same degree of excitement and sort of emotional intensity and feeling like, you know, we were changing the world.
Yeah.
But during that time, I did my online master's degree through USQ, University of Southern Queensland.
Southern Queensland, yeah.
In that time, I was in Qatar, Oman. I was in India for a year. I was in Cyprus. I was all over the place, really.
Yep.
And it was just so exciting to me to realize, wow, you can learn like this. You know, it was all completely asynchronous, obviously, in those days. We had fantastic teachers. Yeah, I just drank it in. It was so liberating.
Mm.
And then I also started working with SADI, the South African Institute for Distance Education. That was making tentative steps into online learning. And we had this thing called Ning. I'm sure you knew about that, you know.
I haven't heard of it, no.
It's sort of a precursor to a VLE or an LMS.
Okay.
It was a social networking platform. You could set up wikis, you could set up blogs. It was so exciting. So from these different parts of the world where I was located, I was working with colleagues there, thinking about how we could use this technology in distance education more formally. And through that work, I came across Jilly Salmon's work on e-moderating and e-tivities, she called online activities.
Yep.
And then there came a time when I started looking for my mum called a proper job. And what came up was an opportunity at the University of Leicester, working in Jilly Salmon's team, actually.
Oh, yes.
It was called the Beyond Distance Research Alliance then. And she had this thing called the Media Zoo, and all the projects were named after animals. But they were all initially funded by JISC in the UK, and they were all part of this program to embed open educational resources and open education in higher education in the UK.
Right.
And some of them were focused on learning design and learning delivery, being innovative. So we're experimenting with things like Second Life and ebook readers and podcasting.
Yeah.
And so I got into higher education then in 2009. Jilly was a huge influence on me. So was Alejandro Armellini, who's now at Portsmouth. And we together ran lots of Carpe Diem workshops where we got academics designing their courses and redesigning their courses in a very visual and fun kind of and rapid way. So during that time, I also encountered the OER Universitas. That was just such an exciting thing because that is this consortium of universities across the world offering bits, pieces towards online programs for students at cost. So aiming at people who wouldn't normally have access to higher education and saying, well, you can do a module through Otago Polytechnic in New Zealand, and then you can do a module through UNISA in South Africa, and you can then do a module through, I don't know, the University of Highlands and Islands in Scotland. And altogether, at the end of it, you'll come out with a bachelor's degree or a general foundation degree or something. That was where the opportunities really seemed to be, because it didn't seem to really take anything away from the universities, but it potentially contributed so much to people who needed it. Mm. I think a key publication for me then was in 2016. I wrote actually a report for the European Council's Joint Research Centre on validation of MOOC-based learning. Mm. They were very much ahead of their time in commissioning this research. There was quite a big team of us writing this paper, and we tried really hard to find examples of people, just members of the public, doing MOOCs and then getting certificates for them and then having those certificates recognized either by other universities or by employers. And at that time, it was very hard. Now, I think it's much more normal to find that. But that was the early kind of the precursor to work with micro-credentials and so on. And it led me to be invited to work in two different projects. One is Chiron, which is a fantastic organization based in Germany. They were set up in 2015, working with refugees and offering MOOCs and pathways through MOOCs into higher education. Mm. And I was already informally a study buddy of one of their refugee students online. And separately, it got me involved with a group called NUFIC in the Netherlands, which is part of an international body of organizations, which are sometimes called NARICs. Not sure what that stands for, but they're national bodies that basically validate people's transcripts and keep, you know, maintain standards across different national boundaries. And we've been doing some work there since about 2022 on recognizing MOOCs and micro-credentials. This is of particular interest to me because of the work that I'm doing with refugees. I started my PhD then in 2017 at Lancaster University on refugees and asylum seekers in online higher education. And I looked at it through a social justice lens. I used the capabilities approach and looked at online engagement and what were the factors that enabled or constrained their engagement. I was thinking particularly engagement is often seen as a proxy for retention, not dropping out. So my thinking there was, you know, if we can find out what keeps people engaged, we can stop people dropping out, because it's often, you know, there's a much higher dropout rate amongst displaced people than the rest of the online student population. Yeah, I did some initial research with Chiron, which was published in 2018 in Open Praxis, and that was a small case study with 10 students. Everything I did for my thesis was openly done, and I was very privileged to be able to contribute a new page to Wikipedia along with my colleague Helen Devard in Canada on open theses. And that was also part of being a member of the GoGN group, which is the Global OER Graduate Network. Fantastic organization, currently led by Martin Weller of the Open University. So I blogged a lot during my PhD and tried to put out all my research outputs as open access. Since 2018, I've been at Birmingham University working part-time in a fairly wide-ranging role supporting academics with learning design. And then in July last year, so just almost immediately after completing my PhD in June, I had the wonderful opportunity of getting a part-time job with University College London. And there I'm working in a team with Tejendra Ferrali, Diana Lorillard, who I think you've also interviewed, Eileen Kennedy, Elaine Chase. And the work that they're doing that I can say I'm part of now is about using MOOCs, but co-designing MOOCs. So we call them co-MOOCs, and that stands for co-designed massive open online collaborations. So they did a lot of that work prior to my arrival with people in Lebanon, and that was in the context of refugee camps and displaced people there. Yeah. And we are currently expanding that work to Thailand, and we're working with people who are displaced from Myanmar, just on the border of Myanmar and Thailand there. So there's a bit of South-South exchange of knowledge, but also really interesting questions that we're working with around how do you use the technology and the affordances available through MOOCs to support and enable teacher professional development, because they're all teachers in refugee camps. So to enable professional development in contexts where some of those teachers themselves don't have access to digital infrastructure. So some of it is going to be completely offline, but mediated through a facilitator or someone in an NGO or a support organization who has access. Yeah. But all the resources will have been built up collaboratively by people across different parts of the region who speak different languages and are going to be working with different technologies. So yeah, that's where I am now.
Gabby, that's an absolutely fascinating account of a very rich career. I'm keen to pick up on one or two things if I can. You've talked a lot about working with displaced persons and refugees, and yet you're also making extensive use of online learning. To some, there might be a bit of a disjunction there in terms of these people not having access to devices or places in which they can actually study. What is the typical experience of a student under those circumstances? Will they have a device? Will they have a place where they can go to study? What's the typical setup that you find yourself dealing with?
Okay, the first thing to say is there is no typical setup. Mm. Most of the research with refugees in these contexts just shows that the environments that people are in differ so widely. The educational background that people bring, the linguistic background, the digital literacies and everything, it is just perhaps like in the general distance learning population, but even more pronounced, it's completely diverse. So the research I did for my PhD involved a wonderful program run by University of Leicester. It was a master's degree, online master's degree in international relations and political science, entirely online. And every intake, they have two intakes a year, they offer six places to refugees or displaced people. So every year they have 12 new students joining, and it's cumulative. They just keep having new students joining. It's been going since 2018. So I was lucky enough to get 10 of those students to agree to participate in my PhD research. Yeah. One of them was in a refugee camp in Malawi. One of them was in Berlin. He had access to constant Wi-Fi, but was on one occasion he was homeless in Berlin for about 3 months. Right. And he told me that he went and sat at the train station with his laptop to access free Wi-Fi there. Yeah. Currently, the work I'm doing with UCL in Thailand, the environment, the circumstances in the refugee camps there are, you know, it's very, very limited resources. Mm. In lots of cases, there's no electricity, let alone access to the internet. And then, you know, there's a small body of literature, a growing body of literature about how different organizations have worked to support people in these circumstances. And it's great that there is all this stuff online that people can draw on, but it's not always immediately accessible to the end user, if you want to put it like that.
Mm, mm. So at the very least, then, someone would need a device that needs some form of connectivity. Do you make a lot of use of offline materials as well, which are downloaded previously onto a device?
Well, okay, so in my previous research, certainly in the University of Leicester master's program, everyone needed a device. And in fact, the guy in Malawi, someone from the University of Leicester sent him by courier a laptop to help him, because it became apparent that he was using a shared laptop in the I think it was the Jesuit Education Center or something, that was, you know, it was a computer that he could only use when other people weren't using it. Mm. But in the work I'm doing with UCL, there's no expectation that all the end users will access it online. But the plan is to find someone along the way who can mediate, facilitate, and enable resources to be made available, either printed or some other format, you know, or bringing one computer into the room and projecting videos onto the screen or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, great. Gabby, the ideas and themes your work has provided that you sense are still pertinent today, what would you like to draw special attention to?
I think all of them. I think open education is still really important. I think recognition of non-formal open online learning, which is morphing more into the micro-credential sphere, but I'm thinking not just the sort of commercial micro-credentials that are commonly talked about, but in general, more flexible opportunities for people at the margins to learn online. It's technically possible, so let's do it, you know. And then the final thing would be social justice theoretical frameworks for higher education. So in my case, I went on a long learning curve about the capabilities approach, which was first propounded by Amartya Sen and then Martha Nussbaum. And there's a group of academics in South Africa who are developing that in practice at the University of the Free State under Melanie Walker. But I think, yeah, for me, that was just so enlightening to have a way of understanding. I think people who are social justice oriented, and me with my NGO background, we tend to be very like hands-on and, okay, what can we do? What can we do? How can we solve it? You know, how can we be strategic in addressing those issues?
Mm, yeah, so there is a whole literature, of course, around that, isn't there? How to best match good intentions with good results.
Yes, yes. And a little plug for the GoGN network again here. I think we've put out as a network crowdsourced booklets on things like conceptual frameworks based on the experiences of all the PhD researchers in the network. So those are really useful. I'd recommend them.
Great. Gabby, we find ourselves now in early 2024. What are your impressions of online education at the present time?
I think online education went through a big learning curve during the pandemic. And I think notions of inclusion, the pedagogy of care, trauma-informed pedagogy, the focus on equity, I think that has remained and that's here to stay, because I think it was really a wake-up call for a lot of academics to realize that they couldn't just expect all their students to be able to sit in a quiet room with a laptop and headphones on and join a Zoom session. You know, that it just wasn't going to be like that for everybody. And suddenly digital poverty people became aware of that. And so I do think that's a really good thing that people are talking about now and trying to address. Another thing that's obvious really is everybody's obsessed with AI at the moment. There seems to be this real worry about making assessment AI proof. And I think it's really interesting and challenging. I think we're in a situation where the curriculum can be created by AI. Some and possibly all of the teaching can be delivered by AI. The assessments can be set by AI. And then students can submit assignments using AI, and these can be marked by AI. So the question is, there's not really much need either for the academics or the students anymore in the entire system. So, yeah, we have to ask ourselves, what is education for? And that really is it's a very deep question. I think we do need to be looking at that. And I think we need to also hold on to what we know is good and tried and tested.
Well, it kind of leads us on to the next question, and perhaps your answer might be a bit biased by the conversation we just had. But what research would you most like to see? You open up a journal, the perfect article is there that's meeting your current thoughts. What is it about?
What I can think of is my kind of ideas of principles that I'd like to be embedded in that research. So equity, I think, is is really, that's been my kind of theme and the thing that I've tried to understand throughout my career. And I think, you know, the temptation is to look for technical solutions to things, but I think inequity is a social problem. So the, you know, questions about how people with limited capabilities for online engagement can benefit from all these current developments. And by limited capabilities, I don't mean limited personal skills, but I mean capabilities limited through social, political, and economic factors that shape what people are able to do. So I would like to see design-based research, you know, which is iterative, it's rapid, it's where you, you know, you try things out, and you have real learners actually doing whatever courses you've developed, for example, and then you quickly get feedback and adjust it and you research as you go along. I'd like to see it being open access in the form of open science, where people share as much of the data as is ethically possible to do and share the outputs, obviously. The other thing is actually research that I'm doing with the UCL group. I'm really curious to see how that's going to pan out, what we're going to learn about how MOOCs, for example, can be used across different areas of digital resources and lack of resources.
It's a wonderfully inclusive series of research topics you'd like to see. There's a real humanity to what you talked about there. So, Gabby, to finish, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
I would like to make a call out for Catherine Cronin, who I know through the GoGN network. She's now an independent scholar. She's a critical and social justice scholar and very much a proponent of open education from a feminist perspective. In her research on open educational practices, she kind of explains that open education is not just all about the licensing and putting on a Creative Commons license and then it's done. She interviewed people, academics who were using open educational practices, and for them often it was just, well, sharing stuff on Twitter, that's open. That's good. That's sharing, you know, opening up my practice. So, yeah, she's very insightful. She has just recently co-published the open access book, Higher Education for Good, with Laura Chernyavik's. So another good one to look out for. And then the other person I'd like to recommend is Taskeen Adam, also a member of the GoGN group. She did her PhD maybe about 8 years ago. She's South African. But she's looked at addressing social injustices through MOOCs. She's looked at decolonizing digital education. She works with the EdTech Hub now, doing really, really interesting research.
Brilliant. They sound like two fascinating people. Gabby, thank you so much. It's been a delightful conversation. And you are the very epitome of a leader and legend of online learning. Thank you for the work that you've been doing.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been lovely talking to you.
You can learn more about Gabby and her work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.